Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you from People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. It's the 160th episode of Give the People What They Want. That's not really the anniversary we're celebrating today. Today is the Lunar New Year. And I just want to just tell you how exciting it is for me personally, maybe for others, that we're entering the year of the dragon. One of my favorite films as a child was Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, epochal film. And so I want to just tell everybody who listens and watches, Give the People What They Want. Please do me a favor. The week ahead, watch the entire Bruce Lee playbook in honor of the Year of the Dragon. Those who celebrate the Year of the Dragon, salutes to you. Enjoy. Well, if you go to the Dawn website in Pakistan, they have the best graphic on the election. They have little Imran Khan running, and Imran Khan seems to be in the lead. He is the most athletic person of the lot, a lot fitter than Nawaz Sharif, coming in just behind him in that little graphic. Prashant, stunning news from Pakistan. Stunning election result. Not fully a result yet, but still, what's coming in, stunning. What's happening in Pakistan?
Right, Vijay, a lot of twists and turns ahead. The results are out for only 119 seats so far. Another at least 100 seats or more, the results are yet to come. But nonetheless, as you said, quite remarkable results. What we see is that the independents, backed by Imran Khan's party, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party, are the single largest force right now. Now, quite a few important things to remember. One, Imran Khan is in jail after multiple massive sentences that he has been hit with, especially over the past week. We saw it almost three sentences taking place, including an absurd one on his marriage. And the fact that he's been disqualified from holding office. His Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party was not allowed to use its symbol and therefore could not contest as a party, which means that all of its candidates contested as independents. And also because it's not contesting as a party, it is barred from getting some of the additional representatives in terms of women's representation and minority representation that it should have got in addition to the number of seats that are contested. But, and of course, this happening, this election taking place after a sustained crackdown on this party, the PTI, over the past year, especially, we saw, you know, many of its leaders, many of its members being put in jail, many declaring that they were actually leaving politics because of the kind of persecution. All of this has its roots, the decision by the Pakistani military establishment, which is really for all these decades has been the key force behind the government, to sort of, you know, eliminate in every way possible Imran Khan as a rival, as a threat to its own power. But despite all these attempts, despite the fact that it not only jailed Imran Khan and attacked its party, despite the fact that the military brought together two traditional rivals, that's Nawaz Sharif and his party, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, and the Pakistan People's Party. These parties have been traditional rivals. The military brought together these two to form a government. Nawaz Sharif, who was out of the country on corruption charges, was brought in, rehabilitated, presented as the, you know, possible next prime minister. A lot of surveys seem to indicate, or a lot of opinion polls seem to indicate, that this was almost a done deal, that Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, was going to come back because, you know, the die was cast, the odds were so much against the PTI, so it seemed. But these results have definitely proved that, you know, the kind of the establishment definitely overreached. I think, there's been an outpouring of support for Imran Khan all through these months, and this is maybe really manifested in the kind of results that are coming out. Imran Khan seen as a victim of the establishment, a victim of this, you know, this military rule, which the military, which has either directly or indirectly been in control of the country for decades now. And that's one thing. Of course, the economic condition in the country also proving a huge factor, massive cost of living, inflation, unemployment, all these crises. The results of decade-long structural issues in how Pakistan's economy has been managed, in how so many people have been impoverished. And while Imran Khan during his rule didn't perhaps do much to sort of alleviate any of these issues, nonetheless, it seems like he has been seen, or he was seen by a large segment of the population, as the one person standing against this corrupt elite and this corrupt establishment. And that probably explains the kind of results we're seeing now. But like I said, there is a lot ahead. We really don't know, you know, how things are going to turn out. At least half the results definitely yet to be announced. There have been all kinds of allegations, very difficult still getting a sense of what's happening on the ground. One thing is that the results have been extremely delayed. We do know that they were originally supposed to be announced on Thursday night itself, but it's Friday evening local time in Pakistan, and we still are nowhere close to it. So, but nonetheless, I think none of this changes the fact that this is quite a historic election, really a blow to the military establishment. I think even irrespective of who forms the government after this, I think that the military establishment, this is the deep state, so to speak, which has very close ties with the United States, for instance. Very important to remember that. Its legitimacy has been seriously shaken. I think there's no denying that.
And some remarkable candidates winning for the PTI, Imran Khan's party, including for the first time a woman elected in Chitral, a very historic victory of Suraiya Bibi. We'll be following this, of course, coming back next week with more of an assessment. Well, speaking of elections, Zoe, when Jair Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil, lost the election to Lula quite a very hard-fought election campaign, right after that, he got on a plane and went off to Miami. Well, it looks like he's now surrendered his passport, won't be flying to Miami soon. Why did Mr. Bolsonaro surrender his passport to the authorities?
Well, yesterday was a day that perhaps many had been waiting for. The federal police in Brazil essentially launched a massive operation to open formal investigations and even arrest warrants for many different people that were involved in what we've talked about on the show, which was the January 8th attempted coup, which took place just 1 week after Lula was sworn in as president of Brazil. Thousands of Bolsonaro supporters essentially flooded Brasilia, invaded the Palace of the Three Powers, attempted to destroy these buildings, the president's palace, the legislature, all in an attempt to call for military intervention to take out Lula, to arrest some of the judges from the Supreme Court, and to essentially call for military rule of the country. This, of course, January 8th did not happen in a vacuum. It did not just one day everyone wake up and decide to invade Brasilia and overturn power. However, it was really built up over months and over years. And what this investigation says, what the federal police have alleged in their investigation, is that not only did Jair Bolsonaro know about this plan, but actually he was essential in orchestrating it. And he had a pretty detailed description of how it was going to be carried out. We know that there were several different moments where they wanted to actually carry this forward. There were attempts to do this before Lula was sworn in. Actually, once Lula won the elections in the second round, there were camps of Bolsonaro supporters outside all of major military barracks across the country. There were road blockades, but they didn't get enough momentum and enough support and really feel confident enough to do it until January 8th. And so in this investigation, for example, the president of the Liberal Party, which is the party that Jair Bolsonaro ran with, he's being investigated. The former minister of defense, and who was the candidate of vice president with Jair Bolsonaro, also. Many high-ranking military officials are actually implicated in this. And so I think for many, it's another testament to the fact that when there is such a subversion of democracy, that the Lula government is actually taking it very seriously. They've clearly been working very, very hard to actually get this list of people to carry out the investigation, to recover this evidence, and to really take a stand and say that against the far right, and show that these kind of crimes will not be permissible. And it's interesting because following January 8th, we saw that hundreds of the participants, the actual people who were on the ground, you know, running into the buildings, destroying things, were actually arrested and being processed. Some of them have different levels of charges. And there was a sense that it was necessary to get behind or get after the people who are considered the architects of this coup attempt, the financiers and the political architects who really gave the motivation, saying that there was electoral fraud, saying that the military needs to invade. And that's essentially what they've done in this case. And we always have the parallel of January 6th in the United States. Of course, we're going to see Trump on trial today for this many, many years later, and really more in a political move than really about bringing forward justice. But that's a whole other story.
It's another story, but it's, in a sense, the same story, because the question is elections, fraud, impunity, and so on. We're going to come back to that in the second half of our show, where we're going to deep dive into Senegal, into Colombia, and into Haiti. All of them, all those three stories about exactly this, Zoe: elections, impunity, postponements. Where is democracy? We'll come back to that. Let's spend a few minutes on Gaza. The reason I want to get to Gaza, of course, is that, well, we know that the war against the Palestinians, the bombardment continues. It's not ended. But there's been an interesting development in the discussion about what Israel has been doing in Gaza. I think that bears some reflection. Recently, in the New York Times, of all places, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, Balakrishnan Rajagopal, wrote a very, very good piece. It's very interesting that this is published in the New York Times, which also did a long story on what Balakrishnan Rajagopal wrote about. Balakrishnan Rajagopal, as the UN Special Rapporteur on Right to Adequate Housing, accused the Israeli government of what is now called domicide. In other words, domicide, the domicile, the place where you live, side, the death of where you live. It's a very interesting article because Mr. Rajagopal goes over how domicide has become an instrument of war. And in fact, you know, I don't think it's become an instrument of war. It has been for a very long time an instrument of war. I mean, we can think of the old medieval attacks on cities where the whole city would be razed, you know, when, let's say, the medieval forces came in and destroyed their opposition. It's not a new thing. But the technology has enabled the mass destruction of modern housing. It's important for people to recognize, before I get to the numbers, that in most parts of the world, a house is a home. There's an emotional resonance to it. But also, a house is your equity. It's, in fact, generational wealth. You know, it's the wealth of a people. You talk about inheritances of middle class, lower middle class, working class people. The main inheritance they have is not a bank account with a lot of cash in it. For God's sake, there is no liquidity for more than half the world's population. They don't have access to liquidity. What they have is the place to live, which is then inherited over time. And a house as an economic resource is very important. Now, the figures that have been put out there by the United Nations, in fact, quite now reasonably accepted, studies done of using satellite imagery of the destruction in Gaza, northern Gaza. This is the area north of Khan Yunis. 82.9, let's just call it 83% of all buildings have been destroyed north of Khan Yunis. 83% of buildings have been destroyed. Now, it's important to remember, some of these buildings were destroyed not by aerial bombardment or by shelling, but in fact, by deliberate demolition, Israeli forces going to these buildings, putting explosives and bringing the buildings down. There are myriad videos of this available, made by Israeli soldiers and put online. There's no contesting the fact that this is happening. So north of Khan Yunis, about 83% of all buildings, regardless of the status, hospitals, schools, etc., but also residential buildings wiped out. In all of Gaza, 60% of buildings have been destroyed. Now, that's more than half the buildings in all of Gaza. Right now, 70,000 homes have been destroyed. They cannot, there's no possibility of rebuilding them. They've been wiped clean. 300 in addition, 300,000 homes in addition have been badly damaged to the point that they need to be brought down and rebuilt. That's 370,000 homes destroyed in Gaza. 650,000 people. I think this number is in fact, needs to be looked at. It's a very low number. 650,000 people rendered houseless. I don't think this is accurate. If 300,000 homes have been destroyed, it's unlikely that there's only two people per home. I think we're close to the 2 million mark here. The 2.3 million Gazans, I think we're close to the 2 million mark here. This is a very serious issue that has been put now on the table. Just yesterday, Antonio Guterres of the UN held a press conference where he said, quite directly, he said, half of Gaza's population is now crammed into Rafah. They have nowhere to go. They have no homes and they have no hope. This is actually something that the South Africans had put on the table in their case for genocide in Gaza. The International Court of Justice came back and said there's plausible evidence. One of the pieces of evidence there was domicide. We're going to keep a look on that. You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you People's Dispatch, Zoe Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. This is a year of elections, major elections around the world, already in Bangladesh, already in Pakistan, many more to come, India, Russia, Venezuela, all going to elections. But it's interesting. We're going to go to places where elections have been postponed. Macky Sall of Senegal, what are you up to, Mr. Sall? Prashant, why have the elections in Senegal been postponed? This is a year of elections. Outrageous. What's going on?
Well, at least Macky Sall seems to indicate that he will hold the elections this year, but maybe in December. That's a big maybe, though. But it's, I think, a very significant development, what Macky Sall has done, because the elections were supposed to be held in February. He announced the deferring of the elections just a few hours before the official campaign was about to begin. And I think very important to note that at the heart of this is the fact that Macky Sall has been an extremely unpopular president, huge protests over the past few years. Of course, multiple aspects to these protests of the economic situation, but also very important to note the sense of discontent people have had with Sall as an agent of French imperialism. There's a very strong belief, a very strong conviction among people, not only in Senegal, but across the region, that Sall has been one of the key, one of the main collaborators of the French, and that has also spurred the protests against him. And Sall has responded by taking, every action possible against his opponents. Very notably last year, Osman Sanko, who was a very popular leader, was imprisoned on quite strange charges, which were later read down by the court. He's still in jail. He's been disqualified from contesting for the presidential election. Another key candidate was also disqualified from the election, another opposition figure as well. All this led to the opposition in Senegal to actually question the kind of electoral procedure that was taking place in the run-up to the elections, and they raised those issues, which Sall one could say it seized the opportunity and then turned it around and then postponed it. A lot of opinion makers and a lot of experts saying that Sall's preferred candidate, his prime minister, was not in any way assured of winning the coming elections, and that is why this measure was taken so that it could be delayed. Sall will now apparently continue as president till December. He said that he wants to launch a national reconciliation process, dialogue, etc. But many analysts seeing this as very much just a move to continue his hold on power, try to suppress more opponents, and try to see if either his prime minister or some new candidate will be able to carry out, or will he be able to carry out the kind of establishment that he has created. Sall, of course, has been in power since for two terms. He's not eligible to run for the third term. Even the fact that he was not running for the third term was a delayed announcement. It was after massive protests took place, number of people were killed, that he made this announcement. So while he's not contesting, his hold on power still continues. And I think very important sign of this is the fact that Parliament, shortly after he made this announcement, Parliament passed a resolution to that effect, but that resolution was passed after police actually invaded the parliament premises, evicted those who were opposing this decision, and therefore that the final decision was passed with a lot of votes. So a very direct police attack on democracy in Senegal, and you know, really raises questions as to what Sall is going to do in the coming months, considering that on this issue he's actually sent the police inside parliament. But of course, a very strong resistance by the people. We saw protests last year as well. This year as well, after these announcements were made, there were protests, the police again arresting a lot of people. I think at least over 150 people were arrested. But tensions are very high in Senegal right now, and I think there is a lot, there's a lot of questions on what Sall is going to do. And I think if he gives the kind of indication that he's, you know, trying to delay elections as much as possible, we are probably going to see once again mass protests, despite however much force he might throw on the ground. So very delicately poised right now in Senegal, for that matter. Macky Sall, of course, is going to be in power. It seems he has declared he will leave in December. But the question is that will the people wait that long? Will he actually, is there any substance to this reconciliation dialogue? And if he gives more indications that he's trying to hold on to power, what will be the kind of protest and opposition? I think those are the key questions before us.
Well, you know, Pakistan had an election. We're waiting on the result. Bolsonaro tried to seize power in Brazil. Macky Sall has decided, I don't want elections now, maybe when the situation is more propitious. And in Colombia, Zoe, there's an attempt to overthrow the government of Gustavo Petro. Democracy, the year of democracy, what's going on in Colombia? What a historic election, and now this.
And well, actually, technically, in this situation, they are calling for election, but an election of the attorney general. We've seen in many different countries in Latin America with these progressive governments, when they triumph and they are president in states, that have been completely controlled by the oligarchy for decades. No, so there's many remaining vestiges of that kind of oligarchic grip on state institutions, on, you know, of course, the structure of the state itself. But many different leaders have actually come, you know, face to face with this issue. Of course, in Peru, Pedro Castillo was investigated by the country's attorney general and charged with really ludicrous charges of corruption, having been in office for such a short amount of time and never having served as a public servant before. In Guatemala, Bernardo Arevalo was almost not able to take office because his party himself was under investigation by the attorney general. And now Gustavo Petro's foreign minister and the teachers' union were both under investigation by the attorney general. The teachers' union was actually raided. The foreign minister of Gustavo Petro, who has been instrumental in so many of Colombia's quite important actions to really rebuild regional integration, to build relations with Venezuela after having the US and Duque having destroyed them. And he was investigated by the attorney general. And Gustavo Petro said that this is an attempt to undermine my government and to overthrow the government. The teachers union, importantly, was raided by the attorney general in the country under allegations that had illegally provided campaign financing to Gustavo Petro. So, of course, this is completely about the Gustavo Petro government and not really about carrying out justice. It's important to point out as well that the attorney general, prior to Gustavo Petro having won the elections, was one of the most sort of hated symbols of the state in Colombia, because this was the institution that was investigating, for example, social leaders, carrying out these campaigns of criminalization of those who participate in the social movements, while at the same time not taking any efforts to investigate the disappeared, the crimes of the military, you know, only doing so under great pressure. But it really became a symbol of this great impunity that so many of Colombians actually suffer under during this conflict where the state has carried out so many injustices against the people. And so right now, that same attorney general is actually leading the attack against Gustavo Petro, and of course is being accompanied by mainstream media, by all of these conservative talking heads who are, you know, occupying the main newspapers and main TV stations in the country, who have been Gustavo Petro's rivals since the get-go, Vicky Davila, Semana magazine, all of these different instruments have just been attacking Gustavo Petro's government. And his response to the raid on the teachers union, to the investigation of his foreign minister, has been to say, okay, the term of this Attorney General Barbosa, who again has been a thorn in the side of not only his government, but of course the movements of the people in Colombia, his term ends on February 14th. Gustavo Petro had presented a list of possible replacements for him back in August. These and he's alleging now that these replacements have not been considered, and that they're trying to essentially swear in a new attorney general who's, again, very close to Barbosa. And he's saying there should be elections, there should be a more open and free process to actually decide who is going to occupy this role. So it's become this point of tension and this point of conflict between the old established powers and, of course, the executive. And so he has sounded the alarm that this is an attempt to destabilize his government. There was a call by civil society yesterday to take the streets in defense of Gustavo Petro's government. We've seen this before, that instead of waiting to get to this very critical point, Gustavo Petro has seen what's happened across the region, has seen what's happened in history in Latin America, and said, what's important is that the people are on the streets defending the government and feel like it's their project, so the government is not left alone. And so it's interesting how he keeps, you know, calling on citizens to you know, come to their consciousness and defend the government as it is a people's project. So there was massive mobilizations yesterday in major cities in Colombia, but of course this conflict is going to continue. I think they did not vote in this proposed attorney general. We're going to see what happens. Do they have this more open process? How does this conflict continue? But again, Gustavo Petro, what does democracy mean when all of the institutions are controlled by your former enemies?
Well, meanwhile, in El Salvador, Nayib Bukele won an election, 98% of the vote, a plebiscite in favor of smashing the gangs, it seems. Smashing the gangs? Well, let's take a look quickly, briefly, in the situation in Haiti. Haiti has actually not had elections, postponed twice, one 2019 and then again in 2023. The very famous massacre that killed the former president, Jovenel Moïse, in July of 2021. A caretaker president comes in, Ariel Henry. Mr. Henry, with no mandate, there's no sitting Senate, there's no sitting government actually with a mandate in Haiti right now. 20% inflation of food goods, lots of people dissatisfied, and a government really that has not been trying to move an agenda to bring back democracy. What is Mr. Henry afraid of? Well, he's afraid of the fact that coming out of the streets of Haiti are a very interesting mishmash of political forces, including returning from 6 years in prison, Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe may not be well known to people outside Haiti. He is extremely well known in Haiti. Mr. Philippe walked around Haiti in 2016 before he was picked up by the United States in a Che Guevara t-shirt. People said, oh, well, maybe he's a person of the left. In fact, Mr. Guy Philippe was the one who orchestrated the coup in 2004 against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a very mercurial, complicated figure, picked up by the United States on drugs charges. The gangs, with their grip on Haitian politics, cannot be underestimated. The people of Haiti seem to be struggling to find a path out of this particular logjam between a government which is not elected and various gang kind of formations. that are very dangerous and themselves have various forms of popularity because they come from the streets, unlike Mr. Henry coming from, in a way, the elite. But there's no real easy choice for Haiti. It's in a tough situation. The fear is that Mr. Bukele's massive victory in El Salvador is going to encourage other leaders across Latin America and in the Caribbean to use armed force against the gangs. Already, the armed police in Haiti been killing people with impunity, with the idea that this is going to allow the state to take back parts of the country which had been lost to them. This is the Bukele strategy, very dangerous strategy, might be adopted by others. We're going to come back and look at a lot of this stuff at your favorite show, Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. See you next week.
Overcome. We shall.